5% of the children placed for adoption by our office do receive one benefit or another through adoption assistance. The average amount of adoption assistance right now is about $400.
And the adoption assistance cannot exceed the amount that would have been available if the child were in foster care. So in turn, it's to reimburse the parent for that extraordinary expense, but it's not seen as a payment as much as it is for caring for the child, just as though the child were in foster care.
Senator Krieger.
Foster parents do incur costs. My Christmas present this year from my foster son was a shirt that said First National Bank of Dad.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said the $400 assistance, is that a monthly payment? Is that an annual? Is that what?
Representative Bowman, yes, that is a monthly payment.
So it's a monthly stipend to assist with?
That's right.
And is it ongoing?
It's ongoing until the child is at the age of 18. Federal law prohibits us from terminating that payment without agreement of the adoptive parent. And every year we send a notice to the adoptive parent saying, this is the amount of money that you're receiving. Have your circumstances changed? Is this helping you to meet the special needs that we've identified? The adoptive parent then has the opportunity to come back to us and say, oh, no, we've had this extraordinary expense. The child needs new leg braces or needs something that's not covered by, it's an extraordinary expense for them. And then we do either one-time payments or increase their monthly amount.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in line with that, some of these children are time bombs. You will adopt them at the age of 8, and then at the age of 12 or 13, the issues that brought them into foster care will explode their treatment needs. So that's why this process is a good one to reassess as time goes on.
Great. Well, I want to thank all of you for making the effort to be here and to talk to us about a very, very complicated issue. I would encourage the committee to take advantage of the offer of the witnesses, that if you have questions, to talk to them specifically and individually about those issues, and I'm sure we will see all of you again at various times within the process. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, for the opportunity.
Committee, we are now past the 10 o'clock hour, which means that we are official. Our 24-hour notice having been given, we can now officially gavel in for the first time the House Judiciary Committee.
Let me get the tapes changed.
Oh, they have to change the tapes.
This is for Tuesday. Okay. Just the agenda, what they need to do.
Okay, now we are official and can gavel officially in the House Judiciary Committee for our organizational meeting. You have on your table before you committee members' rules for the House Committee on Judiciary. These rules are prepared by the Chief Clerk's Office and are the model rules for the House Judiciary Committee when operating with subcommittees. They are very similar to the model rules being adopted in other committees, with the exception of the subcommittee section, because other than Ways and Means, I believe we are the only other committee operating in the House with subcommittees at this time. So the chair would move the adoption of the House Committee on Judiciary Rules. Is there any comments? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I have just a point of inquiry on proposed rules, 12, where it says proposed amendments other than members of the Legislative Assembly. I just don't understand the implication of that.
Representative Ackerman, what often happens is when the committee has a bill, there will be non-legislative members who will come before the committee in testimony and bring forward what they believe would be appropriate amendments to the bill. This simply asks that those amendments be provided 48 hours in advance to staff, so staff can have the opportunity to distribute those proposed amendments to the members of the committee before our meeting.
I think my confusion was I interpreted that to mean proposed amendments to the rules rather than proposed amendments to a bill.
I understand your point of confusion. My reading is those are proposed amendments to bills that would be in front of the committee, not proposed amendments to the rules. Am I wrong about that, Mr. Taylor?
I think you're right, Mr. Chair, but it is ambiguous.
it is ambiguous. That's sort of interesting. I will tell you that the chair's interpretation is that in Rule 12, the reference to proposed amendments is proposed amendments to bills being heard by the committee and not proposed amendments to the rules. Other than committee members, I don't think there's anybody else who can propose amendments to our rules.
I didn't think so either.
Yeah, no, that's a careful reading on your part, Representative Ackerman.
I have another point of inquiry.
Representative Ringo.
The rule number one says how you amend rules.
Right.
So I think it's clear that 12 means bills.
Great. Any other Representative Walker?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just have a question about proportionality. Does that apply, the rules that we have in the House, does that apply to your subcommittee?
Representative Walker, I don't know the answer to that question. We have tried counsel.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, the rules of the House would supersede the rules of the committee. So if you have a rule of the House on proportionality, then it governs the whole legislature. At least that's always the interpretation I've gotten for the...
Well, that's my understanding, that they're in committee. All committees, other than Ways and Means, require proportional representation by the two parties, and I don't see that on the civil sub.
I'm not sure.
I just want to point that out to you.
Yeah, no, Representative Walker, I appreciate you pointing that out. As chair, I serve under the rules as an ex officio member of the civil subcommittee, of both committees, frankly.
Okay.
And so if you strike me as the ex officio member, I think you see that there's proportionality on that committee.
Okay. I'll write that down.
Yeah, and I do think, at least in the structure of the full committee, we've tried to reach proportionality. I don't know the answer of whether or not it's obligated to apply to subcommittees, but obviously you cannot move a bill to the floor from one of the subcommittees. You can only move a bill to the floor from the full committee, and there is proportionality on the full committee. So I think that probably meets the requirement. Any other comments? Any objection to the rules?
I have an objection, but I'll propose it in form of a written amendment.
Okay, fine. So at this point, do you want to hold that objection to adopt the rules?
No.
So you want to propose an amendment to the rules?
I think that's the only thing I can do, can't I, by giving 24 hours written notice?
You can.
Okay.
Okay. Any other objection to the rules? Okay, hearing none, the rules are adopted, and we will expect to see your amendment to the rules.
Yes.
Tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay, we'll take that up at that time. If you could give a copy of your proposed amendment to Mr. Taylor for circulation to the committee as soon as possible.
Yeah, I have it right here.
Okay, at this point...
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I'm going to need to check with the clerk of the House because at least in the House side, I've been told that there's a model rules, and I'm not sure whether we... what the process is, so I need to check. I just want everyone to...
We'll work it out. But the rules do allow for amendment to the rules, obviously, being proposed by members of the committee, so we'll certainly undertake that tomorrow. Okay. With that, the chair would also make the following announcement. The formation of the Criminal Law Subcommittee with Max Williams as chairman, Representative Ackerman, Representative Joanne Bowman, Representative Wayne Krieger, Representative Lane Shetterly, Representative Vicki Walker, and Representative Carl Wilson as members. And the House Judiciary Committee on Civil Law, Subcommittee on Civil Law with Representative Cheryl Walker as chair, Representative Vic Backlund, Representative Kathy Lowe, Representative Charlie Ringo, Representative Lane Shetterly, and Representative Max Williams on as members. And you have that list along with the times that those committees would meet. I would anticipate that the Civil Law Committee would meet for its first time on Monday. The Criminal Law Subcommittee will not meet on Tuesday because of our joint committee trip to the Oregon State Penitentiary and OSCI. So the Criminal Law Subcommittee will meet, I believe, for the first time on Thursday. And members, we hope to have a committee bill schedule for all of next week, prepared and out to you hopefully by tomorrow, so you'll have an idea of the bills that we'll be addressing in the various committees during the next week.
Mr. Chair, I have two questions.
Yes, Representative Walker.
My two questions, I'd like to know the ending times of the committees so that we can schedule our appointments, and then I have another question. So.
Sure. Representative Walker, it is our hope that the committees will... We have a couple of small problems, because on Tuesdays and Thursdays the committee will not start until 8:30, so it would be the chair's prerogative and hope of a committee agreement that the criminal subcommittee would go from 8:30 till 10:30, at least until the time that floor session forces us to end at 10 o'clock, at which point we may try to push that meeting back to starting at 8 a.m. On the civil law subcommittee, it would be the chair's hope that that committee would meet from 8 until 10 to allow 2 hours of committee time in anticipation that eventually the floor session would begin. Those are tight committee times. Where it's unusual for us as a judiciary committee to have a morning meeting. It's traditionally always been an afternoon meeting because our agendas are long, and we've typically been able to run long into the afternoon, but we're going to be battling up against the beginning of floor session. So based on that, I'll use this opportunity to ask committee members to, if possible, be as prompt as you can in the morning. I know it's early, and I know it's tough to get here, but if we don't start on time, we're never going to get our business accomplished before we have to adjourn the meeting for floor session. In addition, I have asked the Speaker's office, and they have agreed to reserve time in the afternoon. So this committee controls this hearing room from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. in the afternoons. And as our agendas mount and we're unable to complete the business of the committee in the mornings, the committee will notice its meetings for both 8 to 10 and then again from 3 to 5, and we will recess and then continue committee work in the afternoons to the extent that the schedule requires. And we're just going to play that one by ear. I wouldn't expect us having to do that immediately, but I could expect in the next month or so that we may be in situations to keep the progress on the bills moving that it would require some afternoon meetings. And I recognize that may occasionally present scheduling conflicts with members of the committee. I recognize Representative Krieger has a committee that has a problem, and we're just going to have to do the very best we can to work our way through that. And it's going to take a lot of cooperation by members of the committee in working with council to let council know where you are at a given time. And we'll try to give you as much notice as possible as committee members if we think we're going to have to go into an afternoon meeting. But I don't want us to get bogged down, and we're going to have a tough time in hour and a half or so meetings getting our business accomplished.
Thank you. And then my second question.
Yes, Representative Walker.
You and I had a discussion about the tour to OSP and OSCI, and I have done that previously, so I am excused from doing that again.
Yes, you bet. Any committee member who feels like they have already been to, and frankly, any committee member that doesn't want to go see the prison isn't obligated to go. I can't send you to prison. But I really would encourage, if you haven't been, and even if you have been before, this is a good sort of committee team building field trip. Jointly shared experiences walking down death row can mean a lot later in our process. And I would encourage you to take part if you can, because it is a very, very eye-opening experience to address some of the issues we're going to be talking about this session.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Lowe.
It's so eye-opening that it is traumatic.
It is traumatic.
For us to have to repeat that experience.
So valuable.
And the sensitivity is my weak little...
Well, I certainly don't want to do that, Representative Lowe. It is not an obligation of any committee member to attend. But I also think it's an extremely important eye-opening experience. So if you can attend, I'd encourage you to do so. I also have several other things I'd like the committee to do together. At some point in this process, I'd like the committee to observe oral arguments before the Supreme Court at some time in the relatively near future. I'd like us to attend a criminal call session at the Marion County Courthouse down the street to sort of observe the morning operations of what the intake and processing process is like for a local circuit court having to sort of be on the ground on these issues. And we also are going to take at least one and at least a visit to one of the OYA, one of the Oregon Youth Authority facilities, fairly early in the process. And I'm hoping to sort of stagger those out over the first month or so, so we don't completely dominate everybody's calendar. But I think it's important that we get out of the building and see these operations on the ground as they're happening, because they tell a story, frankly, that no matter how good our witnesses are, can't necessarily tell when they're sitting in front of us. And we're in Salem with these things being very accessible and available, and we'll take the opportunity to do it. Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to support your contention. I mean, I go to the prison every other month, and it's always traumatic, but it's absolutely key that people who have not been there really have an opportunity to see how our prisons operate. I also would like to encourage us to have an opportunity to visit the women's prison, because that, again, is a facility that I think, unless you see it, people can tell you what it looks like, but unless you actually see it and walk down those hallways and walk over all those beds that are in the dining room, then you don't know, when we talk prison overcrowding, what that looks like. And so I really support the fact that I think everybody should try to make that effort, because it's going to really help us as we move forward in talking about all these issues.
Great. Thank you, Representative Bowman.
Council. Chair, as a committee, we do not have the women's prison on the tour. That can be added or changed for the OSP. The Department of Corrections would like to have us go first to the penitentiary and then to the other prison, because they'd like us to see, I think, things there. We can add that at a later date, or we could switch it, whatever is the choice of the committee.
Council and members of the committee, I guess I'd encourage us to stick with the schedule we've got planned for Tuesday, but let's add that as a later...
When we do the OYA, we could do the women's prison.
Sure, we might be able to do that on the same day. And I will let you know that I have asked to be, for all of the members of the committee, to be excused from floor session on Tuesday if you're planning on attending. If you're not planning on attending the trip to the prison, please inform Mr. Taylor, because he needs to make arrangements with the Department of Corrections, and we'll need to give you some information about what you are allowed and not allowed to wear and some things like that when you go into the prison. And in addition, if you're not planning on attending, please check in with the clerk's office and let them know that you will be on the floor, so they don't have your light turned off as excused for any of the business of the house on the floor that day. Representative Krieger.
After I retired from the OSP, I had had a commercial fisherman that had committed the ultimate thing, killed a deputy, and I felt moved 5 years later to go see him. And he was a friend, still is a friend. And you can't imagine, I took a bunch of pictures of my tree farm and family, people he knew, and they, of course, looked at those. And he was so appreciative of me taking the time to come see him, and that even though a terrible tragedy had happened, I know it made his year, so to speak, because they lose contact with people.
Okay, members of the committee, that concludes the organizational business of the committee at this time, and we will now move on to our second panel, who's been patiently waiting for us to discuss the issues of support enforcement. And if they would come forward at this time, I see, well, I don't, oh, there's Ms. Schenkel, so... Ms. Schenkel, it's a pleasure to see you again. For those of you who were on the committee last time, you will remember that Ms. Schenkel appeared in front of the Civil Judiciary Committee last session, I believe almost on a daily basis.
I think it was.
Wasn't it almost on a daily basis?
I would say she had maybe more regular attendance than some of our members.
Yeah, I that's probably true. I understand we won't see you as frequently this session because of all the good work done last session, but if you'd take the opportunity and introduce the panel or the people that are appearing with you today, that would be appreciated.
Thank you, Chair Williams. Thank you for the welcome back. You won't see me nearly as often, and we're starting on the Senate side, so you won't even see me for a while. And plus, you'll be happy to hear my introduction is shorter this session. I know you'll miss it. For the record, I am Ronelle Schenkel. I'm with the Department of Justice, Division of Child Support, here with me today, I'm going to introduce a few people, but only a couple of us will be speaking. Seated with me is Kevin Aguirre, and he is our Oregon Child Support Program Director. He is with the Department of Human Services and the Adult and Family Services Section. Also in the room, players that you will see from time to time, my counterpart from the Division of Child Support that will be working with me is Cindy Test. And we also have with us, I don't know who's next, okay, Roger Wong is with the Oregon District Attorneys Association. He's the Child Support District Attorney Liaison. And then we also have Carl Stecker, who is a Deputy District Attorney that you've seen before this committee, with Marion County, and he is in Family Support Division.
That's correct.
Got everybody right. You should have a large packet of materials. We're not going to cover everything in detail, so that's the good news. And Kevin, as our director, is going to sort of give you some of the background and introductory information.
Okay. Thank you, Ronell. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is, for the record, my name is Kevin Aguirre. I'm the Oregon Child Support Program Director and as an Assistant Administrator at Adult and Family Services Division of the Department of Human Services. As Ronell said, the staff has put together a very comprehensive packet for you, and I'm just going to hit some highlights on the overview. The Oregon Child Support Program provides services to 215,000 families in the state of Oregon by providing legal services for the establishment and enforcement of orders, as well as providing accounting services for child support cases and, where appropriate, helping to connect families to other community services that are designed to strengthen families. And one of the things I would call your attention to is the mission of the program. I just want to read the mission statement to you. The mission of the Oregon Child Support Program is to help children receive financial support from both parents and to foster the strengthening of families by connecting them to community services. This is a reflection of the evolving nature of the program, both on a national and state level, that traditionally the program was viewing itself from the eyes of the custodial parent, which brought in the child in that equation, but which left the non-custodial parent has not much more as seen as an income source to that unit. We have been shifting our focus, particularly during the decade of the 90s, and continue to shift that focus to view the program from the eyes of the child, which brings in both parents equally into that equation, both financially and then, of course, also introduces what has always been important, and we've been recognizing the program the importance of the emotional side of that equation as well. That having positive relationships with both parents is equally important as having that financial relationship and the self-sufficiency that comes with that.
Interrupt you one moment. Sure. Most of the information that we'll refer to since you got a large packet is in a section with a little cover sheet that says overview of the program. And I think it might be on the right side of your folders.
Yeah. Thanks, Renelle. Has the family demographics have changed in our country and in the state of Oregon, and has our welfare-to-work successes have been increasing, child support is taking an increasingly important focus and importance in the system of services to children. It's both on a national and state level. On the demographics change, more than 50% of children, at least part of their lives, will live in single-parent households. And on the welfare-to-work dynamics, we've helped better move more and more families from welfare-to-work, child support takes on an increasingly important role in helping to stabilize those newly employed low-income families. It can be the difference between helping them stay employed and maybe having them fall back into a public assistance. Also, I think then moving on to this on the statutory basis, federal law requires that every state in the country have a child support program as a component of their Temporary Aid to Needy Families or TANF program. The state must have an approved child support program plan and meet the federal requirements or face the loss of federal funds, not only for the child support program, but for their TANF program as well. Oregon currently receives about 66% of its child support program funding from the federal funds, from the federal matching rate. And just hitting the highlights here. On the program structure, the Child Support Program was established in Oregon in 1975 under Title 4D of the Social Security Act and is a joint federal, state, and local partnership. The Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement, or OCSE, is a part of the Department of Health and Human Services, their Administration for Children and Families. And the OCSE is divided into regions, with each regional office having responsibility for monitoring the programs of the states in their area. And Oregon is in Region 10, Federal Region 10, along with Washington, Alaska, and Idaho. The Oregon Child Support Program Director, myself, is within the Department of Human Services, Adult and Family Services Division. And as director, I'm responsible for the program and policy administration and the oversight of the Oregon Child Support Program. And the Child Support Program Director is also responsible for reporting to the federal government on the Oregon Child Support Program and for obtaining federal funds. We have the directorship in DHS contract with the Department of Justice and its Division of Child Support and with county district attorneys to provide those child support program services to families. And both DCS and the DAs are ultimately responsible to the Oregon Child Support Program Director for the quality of their program and its adherence to federal and state laws. And the Division of Child Support, focusing on them for a second, provides services for any case in which there is currently or has been some form of payment of state funds to support the child, some form of public assistance, such as cash welfare or the Oregon Health Plan, things of that nature. And also cases referred as foster care from the State Office for Service to Children and Families and also juvenile care cases from the Oregon Youth Authority. Persons who receive state support from any of these agencies for a minor child temporarily assign their support rights to current, past, and future child support in exchange for this assistance.
When yes, state Representative Bowman.
You got to the part that I want to talk
okay.
about.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of sessions ago, and I know Ms. Schenkel and I spent an awful lot of time working on one particular case, but the issue is state law requires that if a youth is assigned to OYA, to an OYA facility, their parents have to pay child support to the state. I want to know if we fix that system so that we actually have communication between OYA and the Child Support Division so that we are not destroying families by them just happen to get a bill in the mail. I know Ms. Schenkel knows the case I'm talking about in detail, but I want to know what's been put in place since 2 years ago to make sure that no other family has to go through what that family went through.
Chair Williams and Representative Bowman, I'll pick that question. Kevin's behalf. I do remember the case, Representative Bowman. I don't remember all the details, unfortunately, but I'm sure, and I know I have a record. Some of the things that, or a couple of things that come to mind is I do know that there was legislation passed and there's a better system in place that in which the juvenile courts notify the parents at the time they're in court and before those children go to Oregon Youth Authority that there will be potentially a child support obligation, which enables those parents to get into contact with us sooner and start working together. Another thing that has changed significantly is the mission of the program, as well as the mission of our division, has really refocused us more on family services and less on peer enforcement. So we are doing a lot more in working with families. We may not provide the direct service, but we're linking them up with partner agencies who do to assist them in a more holistic manner than just the enforcement. Now, that hasn't changed the fact that we do still have regulations and statutes in place regarding that enforcement, which was part of the issue. There will be a bill, it's one small step, but there will be a bill coming from the Attorney General. It will start on the Senate side, but hopefully we'll make it over here, that allows us some flexibility once those parents do have an obligation to enter into agreements with them, that gives us more flexibility in the manner and the rate that we collect. So we're trying to look at ways that we can still meet all of our requirements to get our funding and yet have some flexibility in working with the families, if that answers.
Yes, please, Representative.
What was the bill that passed last session that allowed you more flexibility?
Chair Williams and Representative Bowman, let me correct what I said. There was not a specific bill that allowed us more flexibility, but what occurred was the change in our mission and our new approach in working with families has made us go back and look at the laws and interpret them perhaps more broadly than we did in the past. We were pretty much in the past in our history considered law enforcement collectors, and that's the way we looked at the laws, and we didn't seek out that flexibility, but oftentimes, in fact, I traveled the entire state speaking to my division about our new mission and our vision, and I said, we have quoted for years, I did it when I was a caseworker myself, the law says so, challenge me on that. Let's look at the law. There probably is flexibility there, because most of the laws that you pass for us have enough flexibility built into them that we can approach things in a different manner. So it's really more about our approach and not so much that we had to change the laws.
And I would just add that that's also encouraged from the national level, but they've also changed their approach, because in fairness to us, the national approach was like that too traditionally. And they also become more family focused, realizing that parents need to be responsible for their children, but we need to be strategic and also family friendly in how we administer the program. So.
Yes, please, Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my concern is that if you have a 15, 16, or 17-year-old who is arrested and is spending time in an OYA facility while we're figuring out whether or not they're going to be charged with Measure 11 or whether they're going to be charged with something less than Measure 11, what the current system, so the parent has no say in what's happening because we've arrested this kid and said that the kid is an adult, right? But yet they're in an OYA facility, so therefore we tell the parents they have to pay child support because the child is in an OYA facility. And so here's the parent left out there trying to figure out, trying to get information about how they can support their child, but they're being told that they can't talk to their child because their child's an adult and they can't talk to the attorney because the attorney represents the child and not the parent. My concern is that there's still this disconnect between what happens when the child initially goes into an OYA facility, that they haven't figured out how they're going to charge them yet, but they are holding them in an OYA facility, whether or not there is a process in place that actually brings the parent in somewhere and says to the parent, this is the process that your child will go through. These are the options that may be there. Do we have a system like that? And if not, how do we get one?
Chair Williams and Representative Bowman, the point that the child support program, because it involves the Oregon Youth Authority juveniles, is at the point that they've actually had a hearing before the juvenile court and they have been, and I don't know the appropriate term, but they've been, by court order, sent into Oregon Youth Authority's custody at that point. The child support program does not work, at least part of that time period I think you're referring to, where the youth is being held but there hasn't been a court determination. We are not involved yet. We don't even know the case exists. And when we do become involved, we do not go back to that time period. We only go from the point that the court said this youth is being sent to Oregon Youth Authority forward. So through our program, I don't think the remedy you're seeking is there. I think that would really be something that Oregon Youth Authority would need to be involved in, because it's prior, they're involved, but we're not yet in the picture.
They're in OYA, but they're in the custody of the Department of Corrections, right? In that case, would you in fact be requiring child support for those individuals that are 15, 16, and 17-year-old that are in the physical custody of OYA, but they actually belong to the Department of Corrections?
Chair Williams and Representative Bowman, yes. In fact, Oregon Youth Authority brought forward legislation, I can't remember which session, but to clarify that those youth, the Measure 11 youth with the Department of Corrections but actually residing in Oregon Youth Authority, did qualify and fall under the Child Support Program requirements. So we are working with those families as well.
I'm sorry to belabor.
No, please, Representative Bowman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're saying at one point the child is an adult, but at the same time, we're saying the child is a child, and we can't have it both ways. The child is either a child or the child is an adult. And so I guess what we need is probably legislation that says if they're under the authority of the Department of Corrections, they are considered an adult. I mean, we're sentencing them like an adult. So why would we go back and ask for child support from the parent if we have said that the child is an adult? I mean, that's the current system we have. So thanks. I answered my own question, I think. Thank you.
Chair Williams and Representative Bowman, I believe you did a fine job. At this point, I do not think our interpretation is that the Department of Corrections custody has not emancipated that child for our purposes of the child support, so we still look at them as a child. You're correct. The law has not been changed to reflect.
Thank you.
Is that why you're leaving?
No.
I have another meeting.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was describing how DCS gets their cases, that when state assistance is no longer being provided to the child, DCS continues to provide services to the family. This is very important to the program because that keeps that continuity, particularly for those families moving from welfare to work, that they continue to work with one agency, and the focus of child support stays strong. And as I mentioned earlier, that the increasing importance of child support to help better stabilize those newly employed working families. DCS continues to provide the services to the family unit until a request is received from one of the parties or the legal criteria is met to discontinue services. DCS provides these services through 15 local branches that are found throughout the state, and DCS also provides centralized services both directly to the families of Oregon as well as program services to program staff in both DCS and the district attorney's offices, such as accounting, interstate, locate, and some that are mandated by federal law, such as the central registry and the central disbursement unit. Now to the county district attorneys, who also provide services to families, but they provide services to families who are not receiving any form of state assistance. These cases are sometimes referred to as private cases. DAs operate under the same federal and state guidelines as DCS, and they provide the same mandated services to the families. Additionally, the DAs more routinely provide some of the judicial enforcement actions available to the child support program. The majority of child support program offices use the administrative process to establish, modify, and enforce child support orders. As a result, most contested case hearings are handled administratively by the hearings officers of the Employment Department Central Hearings Officer Panel. And then this...
Representative Ackerman.
I just had a question about that. I need to know basically what the relationship between your office is, Division of Child Support, and the hearings referees. Could you explain that, and could you also explain whether you have any ex parte contact with these referees in terms of training, seminars, and things of this nature?
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, I'll do the quick one, and Renell will provide more detail, as she always does. The relationship is based by law that the hearings, and this is not just for the child support program, but for other programs administered by particularly the Department of Human Services, but other state programs, that the hearings unit is an independent body, apart and separate from the service agencies, and that, of course, is designed wisely, I think, for the due process and to get the fair hearing on decisions made by agencies.
The second part of my question is whether you have any ex parte contact with the hearings referees through seminars and training sessions, things of this nature.
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, I have to clarify, we don't have ex parte contact if we have a case pending before an administrative law judge, but we definitely do partner with them outside of wearing that hat and hearing child support hearings anytime that the Division of Child Support has significant training going on for our staff. If it relates to establishing orders or the types of things that hearings officers also do, then they are absolutely invited and welcomed into our training sessions. We have a training program that's 3 days long called Child Support Basic Academy. It's my understanding that it's standard practice that any hearings officers that will be hearing child support cases come and attend that training with us. So we try to keep very linked with what's going on in the child support program and those hearings officers on the panel that routinely hear child support issues.
Just to follow up, isn't it likely that in this process that you're representing a division or the departmental viewpoint that is basically unrebutted? In other words, you're conditioning the hearings officers to come to predetermined conclusions about the interpretation of the child support guidelines.
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, definitely not. They're very autonomous from us. The way that the administrative process works right now is we initiate the action in Division of Child Support, or District Attorney's Office would initiate the legal action and start working with the family. If they ask for a hearing, we prepare packets of information about our records, our information, what we used to bring the legal action up to that point. But at that point, the hearings officer is going to hear testimony from the parents, their attorneys, anyone else involved. They may not even take testimony from program staff. They may just have our paper record, but they make their own independent interpretation and issue a final order. And at that point, if we disagree with their interpretation or how they did it, we would have to appeal just like a party would.
If I just may pursue this, I don't think that quite answers my question. I thought you said that the division does have seminars and training sessions to which the administrative law judges are invited as participants.
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman,
and
that's correct.
Doesn't that give you the opportunity to consult with them or to present your viewpoints regarding the implementations and interpretations of the child support guidelines?
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, definitely so in that light, yes. Since by statute, the Department of Justice Division of Child Support is responsible for issuing those guidelines, not only in those types of training sessions, but also when we are holding our Rules Advisory Committee hearings and representatives from the hearings panel are a part of that process. They do hear from our position, our interpretation of the law from our legal counsel. The hearings officers that hear child support cases at least are generally attorneys, and oftentimes they have their own interpretations, and we talk about that. So I suppose if where you're heading, there is a possibility that they might be swayed by our interpretation, but no more so than when we're working with any of our other partners and we have a difference of opinion about how to read the statutes or the rules.
All right.
Have I gotten there yet?
I just find that very... That process very suspicious as an opportunity for you to, indoctrinate or cultivate relationships with the administrative law judges that the parents and their attorneys don't have. And as a result, in some of the hearings I've had, the decisions are all cookie cutter. They're almost on a format. They don't deviate. Issues that you raise in the administrative hearing are not replicated or answered in the findings and orders of the administrative law judge. Now, let me just ask one more question on this. Do you provide forms for the administrative law judges to follow in their process of adjudication?
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, we do not provide forms that they are required to use. Their forms often look very similar to the ones that we issue in our packets, but that's a determination made at their end and within their divisions and departments. I'd also like to add, if I might, on the last question, when we do have the Rules Advisory Committees about Oregon's child support guidelines, we absolutely do invite to the table advocacy groups that represent both sort of father's issues and mother's issues. We have attorneys from the Oregon State Bar. We try to get anyone and everyone who might have an interest in being involved in the guidelines at some point in the process, so it's not just the state agency sitting down together to discuss how the guidelines should work.
Okay. I can pursue this later. Thank you.
Please continue, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to wrap up my part, this gets to the part of our program where we refer families that were appropriate to needed community services. The program's very proud that we have many other partners that also make contributions to the success of the Oregon Child Support Program. And we have established and continue to work on collaborative partnerships with other state, county, and local government agencies, as well as reciprocal efforts between child support programs in other states across the nation and in other countries. We also value our ongoing and growing partnerships with private organizations, including special interest groups and community-based organizations that serve the variety of interests of child support customers. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Chair Williams and members of the committee, I'll sort of walk you through some of the services now that Kevin has given you, sort of the overview of the program, and those are starting on page 4 of our testimony document. There are 6 basic services if you want to lump all of the various things we do together. The first one being locate. We do have a very extensive process and a lot of agreements with other agencies and access to databases so that we have a very strong locate program within the child support program to find absent parents. Oftentimes that's the first step. You have to find the parent that has left the household in order to start a legal action. We have both the state federal parent locate service and we can access the federal parent locate service as well as all of the databases in Oregon and the regular good old pick up the phone and call and hunt people down types of approaches. That particular service is something that is contracted for a Division of Child Support to provide locate services for the entire program. So whether it's a DCS case or a district attorney case, we would provide that service. I'll also mention, however, I was not going to read them unless you want me to. In many of the service areas, I've listed some achievements, sort of some statistics on how we've been doing in these service areas for your information. Another significant service that we provide is establishing paternity. Many families that come into the program, both in the DCS caseload and the district attorney caseload, do not yet have an order that addresses child support. Some do. Some have gone through divorce. Many do not. They are simply separated or have never been married. So the first step might be to facilitate a legal action to establish an order to address both the support provisions and also health insurance provisions for that family unit. Sometimes when the child is born out of wedlock, before we can even establish a monetary obligation, we have to establish paternity for that child. Now, the quickest way to do that in Oregon, as in most of the states, is through a process called the Voluntary Acknowledgement Program. And that means that there is a legal process available to parents when a child is born out of wedlock so that they can fill out a fairly, I will say fairly simple, I guess that's left to interpretation, form that says, compared to some of our legal forms, it's simple, that says, yes, I'm the mother of this child and this is the father, and they sign that acknowledgement, and that will legally establish paternity. They do not have to go through a full process if they do not need to do so. If they don't want to sign that form, and they don't for whatever reason, or they're not sure that this is the father, then we can take them through a legal process, either an administrative process or a judicial process, and that might involve parentage testing. You can use both blood testing or buccal swab testing, which is taking some saliva on a swab from your cheek area, a lot easier than the blood test and the needles. We primarily are using buccal swab testing right now in Oregon, and we will get DNA results and go through that process to legally establish paternity using either, as I said, administrative or a judicial forum.
Yeah, ask a question.
Yes, please, Representative.
You still have the policy that the father must pay, putative father must pay for the testing out of pocket.
Chair Williams and Representative Lowe, currently either parent can ask for the testing if the results indicate that the man that we tested is the father and a legal paternity is established, then yes, he is asked to reimburse the costs for the most part on those cases. If he is found not to be the father, then he would not be asked to reimburse the costs. So the state fronts the money. Basically, we pay for the test initially until we know the outcome.
And what is the cost for the saliva swab?
Chair Williams and Representative Lowe, I hesitate to quote because I am not familiar with our current contract, but I will tell you I believe it is below $200. I think probably significantly below that because we have a contract in sort of its mass production in the child support program. So.
You have another question?
I do. Could I ask
yes,
you
may.
Thank
<It's>
you.
Coming.
Does that program include other programs like corrections or if somebody wants a DNA test, post-prison, incarcerated people, that kind of stuff? So the cost is roughly $200.
Correct, Chair Williams, Representative Lowe. As Kevin mentioned, anyone can ask for our services, and if we have a case, then that is one of the services that is available at that same rate and through those same processes. And we didn't mention, but it would be possible that if it's not a case that comes to Division of Child Support because the child's in some sort of care, but it's one of those private cases, it's not always the mother and the child, or I should say the custodial parent, but in paternity cases, the mother and the child coming forwards, we do have a process called the self-alleged father, where a man can come forward and say, I believe I'm the father of this child, and start a legal action from that aspect and that angle.
Wow. Thank you.
Okay. Establishing and modifying orders is a large portion of the work that we do in the program. I started talking to you about establishing the orders for the child support provisions and the health provisions. We also do a lot of modification actions. It's very important to our missions and to the families of Oregon that the child support order that is being enforced, that you're paying under whichever side of that equation you're on, that it be fair and equitable at all times. Gone are the days where you have a divorce decree and you pay that same rate for the next 18 years. Federal regulations and state law say that all child support orders or orders with those provisions are eligible to be reviewed and possibly modified every 2 years. So just the fact that 2 years has passed is enough for a family to say to us, I think I need a modification, and we would go through a review based on the current information of the family at that time. And if something significant happens in that family in the meantime, they can also request a change of circumstance modification. If someone's income significantly changes or custody of the children or a new child is born, then they may qualify to have a modification sooner. So we do a great number of modifications, and modifications might result in an order that's higher than the old one or lower than the previous one. It all depends on the current scenario at the time that we go through that particular legal action.
Chair Williams.
Representative Ringo.
Just to follow up on that, let's assume that the father's paying child support, father loses his job, because what he has to do is immediately call you and request for a recalculation of that?
Chair Williams and Representative Ringo, that's the best thing to do. The sooner you can notify the program that there's been a significant change, the better. A change of circumstance modification request, we send out a one-page form, and as soon as they sign it and say, yes, I want you to facilitate this process, then we would start the review to see under the guidelines if that father then qualifies for an adjustment.
And how long does this take?
It depends on Chair Williams and Representative Ringo, it depends on whether or not we're using administrative process or judicial process. For DCS, at least, we use almost primarily administrative process, and a modification could be as quick as, I would say, 45 days. It can take longer. It depends on what choices the mother and the father make along the way. Do they ask for a hearing? Do they ask for amendments because they have more information? But an important piece to know is calling us and letting us know is the key element, because what happens is we notate our system, we send out that form. As soon as we get the form, even though the legal action might take 6 months because they contest it and they want a hearing and they argue quite a while, the effect, when that order is finally modified and entered, it will go back to the date that we initiated the legal action. So we tried to build into the system a process so that delaying your legal action does not delay the modification ultimately. It temporarily does, but...
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes. Then we have the next service is the one that we're, I suppose, most known for, which is the enforcement of child support. And there's quite a bit of information here that covers briefly a lot of what we do. Since 1993, in Oregon's laws, the primary method of collecting child support is through income withholding. And income withholding means basically that if you are employed, we will send a notice to your employer to have them withhold your child support from your payroll. It's not a garnishment. It doesn't mean necessarily you're behind. It just means you have a child support obligation, and it's going to be collected very similar to taxes. Your employer will do the calculation and take it out for you and send it in routinely, and it puts that responsibility on the employer to keep that coming through. That is the way that most cases child support payments are made, because the parent is employed and the money is flowing through their employer's process. If the parent isn't employed or they're self-employed and there's some reason we can't use income withholding, then there are several other tools that we use to collect the child support if payments aren't being made. Garnishments, administrative garnishments, is a very large process in the state of Oregon now. That means that if the obligated parent has some sort of account at a financial institution, and that might be anything from a checking account or savings account to stocks and bonds types of things, we have the availability and the processes to do an administrative garnishment and take money from those accounts, of course with due process and notices built in, but we will go out and try to seize that asset through a legal process. We also do tax intercepts. Federal regulations and state law both require us to intercept both state tax refunds and federal tax refunds if a person is delinquent in their child support payments and meet the criteria under those laws. We often use for folks that lose their jobs but they're on unemployment compensation or perhaps workers' compensation, then we have another process that we use that's very similar to the income withholding but a different calculation, of course, where a portion of the money from those benefits will be sent to the child support program for the child. And we place liens on real and personal property so that if there's a sale of property and someone is behind on child support, then a portion of the proceeds of that sale potentially will go towards the child support obligation.
Schenkel, just a question because you're on that segment of it. Most of the obligations are what, court ordered or as a result of a stipulated agreement in a divorce or something of that nature?
Vice Chair Krieger, that's correct.
And then my question would be, is it through services of families and your agency, when does the process start when they are in arrears of payments for how long? I mean, if they're delinquent for a month, 2 months, 3 months, when would you pick that up in your accounting system?
Vice Chair Krieger, there are several points that people come into our process. For division of child support, the point that they enter into our caseload is when that child gets some type of state assistance, as Kevin referred to. The child goes on cash welfare, on the Oregon Health Plan, into foster care or juvenile care. By a computer link between our agencies, we'll get notice to start working that case, which would mean facilitating legal actions, using enforcement tools, all those types of things. At that point, we would first have to look and see what the status of the case is. Do we have an order? Are the parents current and we just need to do the ongoing collection? Are they behind in their child support and we need to use additional tools? For each of the enforcement tools, depending on the severity, if you want to call it that, of the tool, we have thresholds on how far behind you are before we start to apply the tools that are stronger, perhaps. So as soon as you're 1 month behind, you qualify for a new type of collection, which means we need to try to collect at least your child support monthly obligation and an additional 20% of that. So, for instance, if Mr. Taylor had a child support case and he owed $100 a month and he's behind even by a month, we would try to collect $120 from him until he got caught up.
And Vice Chair Krieger, it's obviously a balance of trying to be accommodating and flexible on when parents can pay, but also a concern of not wanting them to get too far behind where they start digging a hole for themselves.
Well, that was my concern, yeah. And I know of a couple cases where things are of this nature, and nothing's been done for 4 months, and the receiving family, you'd never pick them up anywhere because they receive no benefits from anywhere.
Vice Chair Krieger, any family, as soon as they're the obligated absent parent gets behind in child support, certainly can walk into the door of any child support office and fill out an application for services. You have a copy of the program's application form in your packet, and they're entitled to services. They would probably be assigned to a district attorney's office at that point if there was no state assistance, but they would get the same services, and we would generate those income withholdings or use those other tools. As soon as they can come in if they're current and still say we want your accounting and your enforcement, or if they're 1 month behind, we're ready to provide that service.
Ms. Schenkel, is there a priority system for that if they're on public assistance or if it's a private order? They already have the order, but they need enforcement because the parent is delinquent on the payments. Is there a priority system for that, or they just come in as chronological order as they walk through the door?
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Walker, sort of. We don't prioritize by how far behind cases are or anything to that nature. We do have to, of course, balance the resources in the program with the caseload that we have. So we do have a small amount of prioritization in that there are federal requirements on how fast we have to establish paternity, for instance, and how fast we have to establish an order if there is none. So we prioritize only to the manner that we need to make sure we're meeting federal time frames. But there's no magic system as far as, you know, we start working cases A and go down to Z, or we start with the people that are $10,000 behind and work backwards. It's not that sort of prioritization. We work all of the cases. A lot of the work that is done has been automated, and so the computer can generate notices or generate alerts to workers and say this needs to happen. So we're consistently working a large quantity of cases at any given time, if that answers your question sufficiently.
Because, Representative Walker, the Oregon Child Support Program, through our federal participation, is an entitlement program, so everyone has equal access.
Ackerman.
Ackerman's
great. Right, thank you. I just have a question about the tax intercepts, and that involves the seizure of joint returns where the obligor is, say, remarried and it's a joint return. Are you intercepting the entire amount? In the first instance.
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, if you define first instance as the way that the process works is we do a data match. We send a tape, an electronic, a computer tape to the Department of Revenue, for instance, and we say these are the cases where the families are far enough behind that they qualify for an intercept. They will then match that against their records as they process refunds. So initially, if there is a joint return, the computer won't know that, and it will mark that case and send a notice out to that obligated parent. Right on that notice, it tells that obligated parent that there's a process that I'll call the injured spouse, where they can contact our program and say, hey, this was a joint return. Part of this money is my new wife's money, and she doesn't owe child support. And we have built into the child support program an expedited process where we will refund if they're in the point in their refund process where Department of Revenue has issued that money over to us and they took the whole amount, we will forward money out of the child support fund
for that injured spouse portion and make the adjustment when the check actually hits the program. So they will be identified because we don't know until they file whether or not it will be joint. But as soon as they are identified as a potential intercept, they get a notice, they call us, we start a process to get that portion of the money back to them.
Suppose you don't get the call because the taxpayers moved or didn't get the notice, then you are still staking the entire amount. Is that correct?
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, that could potentially happen, yes. I believe that the child support program is pretty progressive in keeping our addresses up to date because of all the interaction we have with families. So hopefully we have an address that they're, even if they're not there, they're still at least receiving their mail because it's a relative or someone that will get that notice to them. But certainly that could happen, and they may not notice until they think, gosh, I should have my refund by now, and why isn't it here?
Well, at what point do you make the apportionment after the entire amount is seized?
If, Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, it's sort of in that transition period. Technically, it's been seized, yes. What happens is the Department of Revenue, in my example, sends out a notice and says you're entitled to $5,000 refund, but you're not going to get it because you owe child support. So instead of a check, they just got a notice. Anywhere in that process, whether or not we've actually received that $5,000 from revenue, they can call us, contact us, bring it to our attention, and we'll get that spouse's portion of the money back to them, whether or not we've even gotten the funds.
I guess I'm trying to understand. There are situations then when you have the entire amount, even though you're not entitled to it, before the allocation is made.
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, the program... That may happen, yes,
okay.
Because we cannot tell until we actually file whether or not it's going to be joint or single.
Okay. Let's assume you got the whole thing, the entire refund. Then how is that allocation made, and what happens if there's a dispute?
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, if we got the whole fund and it was joint filing and nobody told us that it was and that that was an issue, we would apply it to the child support case because we won't collect more than they owe to their child, so that money would flow through to the family. And at some point then if they came back and told us that that had occurred, then we would take the appropriate legal action to make the adjustment and correct the case.
Is there an administrative time period to request that allocation?
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, I'm fairly certain there is, but I don't know that off of the top of my head. We can certainly get that information to you if you would like.
I see somebody in the rear nodding their head, and maybe maybe the answer is in the gallery.
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, Cindy Test, who is working with me, actually works at the constituent desk and is much more familiar with casework than I, so if you don't mind, she might know the answer.
I have her come up. Make sure you identify yourself.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Cindy Test, and I'm partnering with Ronell this session. Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, that is a 30-day time period for an injured spouse to request their share back of their refund.
Okay. And if that time period goes by, then you keep the money.
Representative or Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ackerman, that is correct. That time frame is in statute and federal code, IRS code.
I just have a comment. I think there's some real due process problems here, and I think we should look at some of the large class action cases that have hit the state over the past several years, which have created a budget shortfall. And I think you may be teetering on that unless you perfect your processes.
That could probably be a good point for discussion with you and them sometime. I think you've got the expertise as an attorney.
No, I haven't seen it happen, but, you know, we, well, I won't get into, you know, all of my reasons, but I think that this is an at-risk situation. And, you know, these class actions, you can imagine what this class would be, what the amount of money would be. There's some incentive out there for litigators to look at this one. And this just ends up costing the state a lot of money.
I want to get to Mr. Taylor. Mr. Taylor, did you have a question from Mexico?
I didn't, Mr. Chair. I was just asking you to have her identify herself for the record.
Okay.
But one follow-up point. I'm sure Ronell Mishenko will probably be discussing this issue with her attorney with the Department of Justice after this hearing. So, and I'm sure that she'll be able to get back to Representative Ackerman with their feeling on the issue.
Well, I know they're taking some notes here and there. Different people are, so.
Vice Chair Peterson, may I ask a question?
Yeah. Go to Reno.
Just changing the subject a little bit.
Ringo?
I've seen a number of occasions where child support is owed and the deadbeat parent isn't paying, and it's difficult to collect because the deadbeat parent is getting paid under the table. They work for a construction company and it's paid cash, or in a restaurant or a bartender, and you just, it's too hard to garnish. And I've heard that when this is brought to the attention of, say, a DA's office or a support enforcement division, the response has been, well, we don't have the resources to investigate this, because you'd have to investigate it to prove that that deadbeat parent really was getting income under the table. And I'm wondering, I also understand that there's, I mean, right now, if you hit that employer with a garnishment, they would be in violation of the law because they are paying that person. But I'm wondering whether more resources should be applied to that, or what is the solution to that problem?
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ringo, that is an ongoing concern. There are many obligated parents who learn how to hide from the program. However, the federal government, and then we've enacted in state laws, stronger and stronger tools that are improving and reducing the number of people that can work the system in that manner. You asked several questions. One of them with regard to the employer, if the person is working there and legally we can prove that there is liability and there is language in the law that would allow us to take action in that scenario.
Okay, but practically speaking, how is the owed parent going to follow through and make that happen?
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ringo, for the most part, they're going to call us and report to us. And
okay.
I do believe that your constituents have probably heard we don't have the resources for investigators. Technically, to a degree, that's true. We do not have a large force of investigators that go out on the streets and sort of watch parents' activities. District Attorney's offices may have more resources available in those areas. I can't speak directly to that. The Division of Child Support is currently piloting contracting with a couple of investigators to be able to start to see whether or not that's a cost-effective use of state resources to do that. But I think that the...
I'm sorry, just to follow up on that. I mean, because I was wondering about the cost-effectiveness of this. I mean, is this an area where if we were to invest more state resources in this investigation, we would have a multiplication factor in terms of what would be paid back, and how would we know that?
Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ringo, that's part of what we, at least in DCS, are going to start to look to. It's true that first we're going to look to the tools we have, and we have gotten stronger tools in the past few years. The program that got a lot of attention that was part of the Child Support Provisions of Welfare Reform called Financial Institution Data Match is an incredible tool, because basically that means we're contracting with financial institutions, which means a lot more than just banks and credit unions. There are thousands of people that qualify under that definition. And what we do is data matches with the Child Support Program. If someone owes child support, we're doing matches with all of these accounts to see if there's an asset, and then we can use that garnishment process to get that. We didn't have that in the past, and so people that were working under the table could have their money tucked away in bank accounts, and it was harder unless you had an investigator to go prove that.
A lot of people operate in cash, though.
Correct, Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Ringo, that's true. The tools that I mentioned, we will first try to apply most of the tools that I've mentioned, the ones that we are resourced for and have laws in place to use. Many of the cases that you are probably referring to come down to the need for judicial actions, where you do have to get tougher and you have to be calling people in to be interviewed, taking them to court for contempt, those types of more significant judicial actions. The Division of Child Support does not, we provide those services, but not as often as the district attorney. So perhaps when Mr. Stecker or Mr. Wong come up at the end, they might be able to circle back and speak a little on how they...
Just one more thing. Could I just have somebody from your office call me about this? Because I don't want to take up the rest of the hearing here, but I do want to give more attention to this problem and see whether we can come up with some other solutions.
Vice Chair and Representative Ringo, definitely. At any time,
okay.
We are available to any of you to talk about issues that you might have or concerns.
Yeah. Okay.
Vice Chair Krieger,
if you'll excuse... Thank you. If you'll excuse my previous lapse in protocol a moment ago, I'd like to ask another question. Ms. Schenkel, you're talking about enforcing the child support orders. What about when those children reach the age of 18 and they're still in school? What is the state policy on that? Are there legal requirements in regards to enforcing that while they're still in school or some other type of non-emancipated status?
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Walker, Oregon does have laws that require, we call them our child attending school provisions, and it does require after you've met certain criteria that child support will continue to be owed and will continue to be enforced up until the age of 21 in Oregon if a child qualifies as a child attending school as defined in the statute. There have been many, many bills and many sessions that have come before judiciary committees on that topic. I believe I've already seen one come out this session, so it's likely we'll be talking about that. It's a pretty complex area of the law and the enforcement, and I'd be happy to answer questions now, or I'd be happy to come in and give you quite a bit of detail about where our laws currently stand. It's a very involved process, but the quick answer is in Oregon, for children between the age of 18 and 21, if they meet the qualifications in the law, there is still a child support obligation, and the program will still enforce it.
I have one follow-up question. Ms. Shenko, I understand that in another state, I believe Pennsylvania, there was a lawsuit on that issue because they have a similar statute based on equal protection that the parents who are living with their children are not under legal obligation to pay child support once they're beyond 18 at child attending school, and parents who are separated and have a child support order are. What was the result of that decision?
Vice Chair Krieger and Mr. Taylor, I'm not sure the result in that state. There has also been a lawsuit in the state of Oregon. I do not know the current status, but we can certainly report back to the committee on that. But I believe it was a very similar issue as far as the equity issue between the families.
Thank you.
Back in our testimony on page 7, and I'll just sort of really start going over this.
Got about 10 minutes.
Correct. We have some information for you on performance measures. The child support program is measured in several ways, and we gather statistics and report in several different ways. I talk about the federal incentive system. You have some handouts if you want to see. That system has recently changed, and so we're transitioning from the old way that we were measured to obtain that additional incentive money from the federal government to the new. So we have information on that. We have a self-assessment program where not necessarily tied directly to money, but definitely a program requirement that ultimately is tied to money. We have a team of staff that are continually reviewing our entire program, the work that we're doing, and both in Division of Child Support and District Attorney offices to make sure that we're meeting all the federal requirements, state requirements, doing and providing those services that we are supposed to. I list out those areas that we are required to look at. Through that process, there's one Oregon benchmark related to child support. I have that in your handouts as well. It's mostly focused on a collection piece of our service. And then in Division of Child Support, since we're a fairly large percentage of the program, we've recently developed measures that we're going to measure ourselves on as far as service. And some of those include those federal and state requirements, but we're also branching out measuring some of the other things that go with our new mission about other services to family beyond just the dollars. So you can see information about that as well. I then have a section starting on page 8 that talks sort of about two things, both environment for the child support program, what are we hearing and what's coming from the federal level, and then achievements, what's been going on in Oregon. And there are several areas here I will not go into detail unless you hear one that you want me to. Kevin mentioned the mission. I'll just mention again that there's notes in here about that because that was a significant change. And as he said, not just in Oregon but nationally, the fact that we're moving the focus off of pure enforcement into more holistic services, whether we provide those or we work with other agencies to do so, I think is a major, major step. We talk about the change in caseload, which Kevin also referenced, and I think that statistics show us that our caseload is going to change. It is going to move away from being a large portion of the child support caseload in Oregon being families that were on assistance, and it's moving more and more towards families maybe were on assistance but they're off, or they're coming in as private cases and they stay in our caseload and obtain our services. So less and less working with state agency refund type of issues and more servicing families long term.
Okay. Representative Lowe, your question?
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair Krieger. I think this question's for you, and maybe it's for Carl too. But in the new and improved child support division that's more user-friendly and more holistic, what efforts have you made to pass this word down to the various counties, the DA's offices, and what changes are we seeing there? And I know Carl's been at this for 5,000 years, so he would know, I guess.
We would all probably say the same thing. I'll jump in. Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Lowe, I'll sort of start and let my two counterparts add to this. I think a huge step was having a program mission, really as an entire program with all three entities involved, Adult and Family Services, where the director is, Division of Child Support, and the County District Attorneys, coming together and saying, we now have the same focus, and that is a broader focus, was a very major step for us in Oregon, and it's a very recent step. That's been since last session. Our division had started our mission, but we now have the program mission. Adding on Mr. Wong's position, the district attorney liaison, has also improved because we now have a person dedicated to help spread and communicate and make sure that in all those counties where we're spread out, we're having that communication, we're partnering, we're improving services so that we are more, the lines are more invisible between the different parts of the program. So I'll sort of start there and then Carl, if you want.
Certainly. Thank you. Members of the committee.
Identify yourself, please.
Yes, I am. My name is Carl Stecker. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County. I'm in charge of the Family Support Division of the Marion County District Attorney's Office. And to address Representative Lowe's question, Vice Chair Krieger, Representative Lowe, in essence, we have moved, I think, to a program that now seeks to separate those who are unable to pay versus those who are unwilling to pay. And I think that becomes really the essence of what maybe distinguishes the DA's use of judicial remedies versus administrative remedies. The district attorneys, as I think Ms. Shankle has explained, use a plethora, a wide range of remedies that include purely administrative processes, but also resort to the court where and when necessary. And part of this holistic movement is in an effort often, if we have no information to address Representative Ringo's question, we do have an investigative resource, and if we determine that somebody's in fact receiving Social Security or truly unable to pay, we can offer services to modify that person's order accordingly. But by the same token, if we identify that person as a self-employed person or someone working under the table, we can take appropriate judicial response, which can include a judicial order to withhold, and if that is ignored, we can bring a contempt of court against both the obligor who is to pay and the employer with whom we've served with a judicial order. So there are methods by which we can extract funds where and when necessary. One of the areas that becomes, you know, very controversial certainly is when we start to issue writs of execution, seize people's vehicles, those sorts of things. Those actions, because they are fairly complicated, are very rarely employed. And that's a resource issue more than anything else. But it is an available remedy, and it's one that we've used in rare cases. Criminal non-support is a felony in this state, a Class C felony, and that is brought to bear, and folks are indicted in DA's offices throughout the state when necessary to assure that we get them on the hook. And obviously we're interested fundamentally in collecting funds, not in prosecuting people necessarily. So there are often deferred prosecution agreements or diversion agreements, and people enter into probationary terms by which they make payments.
Representative Lowe?
Thank you, Carl. I know all that. We've done all that together.
Sure.
But the question that I have is the change in focus to being more accommodating and more holistic. I recall that there were monetary incentives offered to the district attorney's offices for efficient and thorough collection. The more you collected relative to your relative caseload, you got some economic incentives. Are you telling me that those incentives have been discontinued, or are you being given economic incentives to, say, pursue visitation orders to bring more harmony between the warring factions? You know, what's the story there?
If I may, I'm going to defer to Kevin Aguirre on
Thank
some
you,
of these
Carl.
Questions.
Vice Chair Krieger and Representative Lowe. First, to the original question you had about how is this message filtered down through the whole program, the mission itself was a product of the entire program's input and, of course, our commitment to it as a program and through all three agencies that are represented here at the table, in fact, and through all the representatives throughout the state. So it was a mutually developed mission statement that we're all very proud of, and one that, because of that,
it becomes a committed document for all of us. And that didn't just include, you know, sending it out and asking for comments, but myself and Cindy Shinnok and Roger Wong traveling to all the district attorney's offices and having a dialogue about what does this really mean, and is this something we can really commit to? And then on your question on the incentive structure still remains for the district attorneys. It's still there, and will remain there. The program, though, just so we still do not provide the program those visitation services. But what we do is recognize how important those services are on the emotional needs of the children and connect them, those families, into the available resources in the community. So that gets back to how the program has changed, that we didn't always recognize ourselves as part of the system of services to children. We kind of thought of ourselves as an isolated program, and oh, by the way, you can go somewhere else if you need those services. We recognize that if we are about what's in the best interest of children, then we have a higher responsibility than that, and that's to help connect families to those services.
I'm going to kind of shorten this up here. If you have any further need of a contact with these people, and you'll be available, won't you?
Absolutely, Dr. Krieger.
We much appreciate you coming. We learned a lot. We'll make just one announcement for tomorrow. Be here at 8:30 again in the morning. Subject to be Oregon Judicial Review, now in the future, with Chief Justice Warren Carson, Judge Pamela Abernathy, Marion County. And also, where are we going in the civil liability? Stephen Bushog, Oregon Department of Justice. Any other comments?
Chair, if I could add one thing. We will have one bill on tomorrow.
We will?
Yes.
Okay. Anything further?
It's a very simple bill. So.
Okay, we're out of here.